This story, Franz said, it was a little woman, will have to hide itself in the world. The others will have an easier time of it, though. Those you'll burn. No, Max said, I won't. He steeled himself. The world, he knew, would thank Max for his great refusal. Max, you're my dearest friend. I know you can't ignore my dying wish. Franz Kafka's dearest friend. Brode felt deeply honored. How could he not do as Franz asked? I most certainly can and will ignore your request, Max said. I won't do it. Franz Kafka's work would be like a well of water for the world. As if in reply, Kafka described a small revision he would like made to another of the unpublished and therefore supposedly to be destroyed manuscripts. Max felt like Kafka was teasing him. If so, the activity must give Kafka a little ease, and so, as his closest friend, Brode would simply have to bear it. And strangely, just after Brode had this thought, Kafka said, do you think the ebb and flow of pain means the angel of death is teasing me, the way a cat plays with a captured mouse? Cruel the cat, Brode said, also meaning Kafka cat towards Max Mouse. Cruel, yes, Kafka said, but not malevolent. The teasing is probably more meant to ease the torment the cat feels than to add to the pain of the mouse. That made Brode sure that Kafka's disease had, if such a thing were possible, increased his sensitivity, allowed him to read Brode's mind even more clearly than he had before, when Kafka had often understood him without Brode's knowing how, and in a way that saw Brode's concerns in their purity. The ambiguous gift of such a vision being that Max's worries, seen that way, became stunning, crushing, insoluble burdens. And he could no longer imagine any more what wine he might rightfully drink if there was no one to pray to who might bless it. But why, Brode asked, does the cat need to distract himself from his joy in his meal? Joy? Oh, no. Cats loathe having to earn their wages by killing mice, who in themselves are not only living beings like the cat, but in addition have for them, the cat, the thoroughly bitter taste of the cat's servitude. How awful for both of them, then. Worse for the mouse, Kafka said. Yes, it's about to die. Max had lost track for a moment which of the two of them was the rodent. Not that only, but the mouse must forgive the cat his death as well, Kafka said. After all, by hunting and eating mice, the cat is doing what it must to get a place indoors. Cats seem so sublimely indifferent to everyone, only so they might bear with dignity their sense of the depth of this degrading slavery. And the angel of death, Max asked? He's just like the cat, Kafka said. He does his master's bidding, but he hates his work. Who else would God have chosen for the task? If he employed an angel who rejoiced in vengeance, humanity wouldn't have lasted an instant. Instead, God chose an angel of the greatest sensitivity, one who feels every death to the core of his being. So we shouldn't begrudge the angel the momentary distraction he gets from tormenting us. Of course, he also takes a little revenge on us, too. After all, isn't it the man himself who forced the angel to do this hateful thing by being unfit for life? Forgiving the angel had exhausted Kafka this afternoon. He closed his eyes. Brode stood by him for a moment before he left to make sure Kafka was asleep. In my story, Brode wonders throughout his life why his angel, Kafka, had given him a task whose contradictions would crucify him. Was he being an angel of death himself, or trying to turn Brode into one? Had Kafka meant to do a piece of fairy tale magic, turning Brode into a character in a story by Franz Kafka? And towards what end? Max wants it to be towards a good end. That is to say, Max wants the guilt he feels in not fulfilling his beloved friend's request to have a special purpose for Max, to have been meant by Kafka as a kind of therapy for him. If he can figure out what Kafka intends for him by his impossible request, Brode feels he can die more peacefully, which is every good Jew's goal in life. But I won't tell you what he concludes Kafka had in mind. For that, I hope you'll read the story. Why do I do that? I do that because every writer now competes with Mad Men and The Americans. So we have to do our own advertisements. Anyway, as I was reading about Brode, Kafka and his world, I met the Dora Diamond. At 25, Dora had fallen in love with the 48-year-old Kafka, and he, I strongly believe, with her. Dora was the daughter of a Polish Hasidic Jew who, on her own and against her father's wishes, left her family to work in Germany. That sentence, I hope, says a great deal about Dora's enormous strength of purpose, her curiosity, her independent mind, as does this sentence. She loved the difficult Franz Kafka, who was already dying of tuberculosis. After Kafka's death, Dora went on to become an actress in the Yiddish theater and to marry a prominent German communist, Lus Galask. The two worked diligently against Hitler, even after Dora became pregnant with their daughter, Marianne Franziska. Yes, the middle name is for her first husband, Franz Kafka. And yes, Dora continued to brood on what she thought had been her most priceless inheritance, her time with Kafka, which brooding, of course, drove her husband, Ludwig Lask, crazy. Here's an excerpt from my story about her and Lask and their daughter. Every word about Kafka, and it seemed like Dora's mouth released flocks of them every day, hurt Lask like a sharp peck to his body. And it wasn't just words. Dora's Kafka Museum had objects in it too, like the picture of him, or a fountain pen, or even a hairbrush of his. He loathed those things, and even more that she sometimes got small royalty payments from Kafka's estate. "Don't be foolish," his mother said. "She needs the money to live on so she can struggle for the rights of the proletariat." Bertha thought her son too much troubled by a ghost. This ghost, however, was very real to Dora, perhaps because when alive, the writer had himself foolishly believed in ghosts. "Her feelings about this man will change," his mother said. "That is, if you want her enough to give her a child. When you do that, the phantom will disappear like so much mist." Soon Dora petitioned the party to change her membership to his cell, and she moved in with him at his parents' house, where life together gave Lutz many opportunities to eavesdrop. It was the same when he prepared tea for a visitor, he heard Doris saying to his mother one morning, and he stopped outside the kitchen door to listen. When Franz performed even a simple, seemingly insignificant action like that, Dora said, he made it seem as if he were doing it for someone that he revered. His mother, from the sound of it, must be making Dora some tea, though apparently with an inferior, only human level of concentration. His manner gave everything he did a religious intensity, Dora said. And Lutz could easily imagine her infuriating, fond smile. Of course, this thoroughness kept him so busy that he didn't manage to put the cup of tea on the table. He used up all his strength in the preparation. His mother, though, placed something that sounded solid on the round glass table in the alcove off the kitchen. "Then there was no tea, Dora?" his mother said. Was it Kafka's concern that friends were supposed to drink? You make me wonder if the man had ever been thirsty. At that, Dora had run through the swinging door and right past Glusk. She said nothing about his spying, just rushed on towards their bedroom, weeping. Apparently, no one but Kafka had ever known what thirst truly meant. Lusk decided to learn all he could about his rival. He read the trial, unfinished, and the castle, also unfinished. Both of them stories about and by a petty bourgeois defeatist who couldn't even manage to give his character a name. They showed no social and political awareness. Lusk told that to Dora as he and Dora leafleted on Unter der Linden. She said nothing and handed a man in a cloth cap a leaflet for their last big rally before the vote and smiled at him. But the man didn't look at the lovely gesture in his rush to get to a warmer place. Lutz, overcome by love, decided he must get Dora a warmer coat. Their post was near the university, a place busy with a mix of students, bourgeois, workers. Yet as everyone rushed by, their faces set against leaflets and cold, Dora said she felt like it wasn't the German working class against Hitler anymore, only the two of them. He reassured her that the party had posted many other teams up and down the avenue, and in any case, a communist should always know he's not alone. He's part of the masses in motion. But what if a communist wanted, if only occasionally, to be alone with his wife? How could he do that as long as a ghost was always with them, too? Lusk had to reduce the writer in size so he could blow him away. He told Dora that the trial was meant to convince the petty bourgeois that one needn't take up the struggle for justice. A man was an isolated atom, and all struggles, Kafka's work implied, ended in defeat. Dora oddly agreed. Joseph K.'s struggle was futile, but Lusk didn't understand why. In fact, no one who hadn't known Franz would understand him. That will certainly limit his readership, Lusk said. She ignored him. Franz condemns Joseph K. because he tries to shape his life differently from the life of crucifixion, the only life there is. Dora, he wanted to say, to cry perhaps as if from the cross. If you think there's no life but crucifixion, what do you think we're doing here handing out leaflets? What are we struggling for? You can hold back from the suffering of the world, Dora said. But perhaps this holding back is the one suffering you could have avoided. He could tell from her tone that she was quoting him and wondered why the phrases didn't make his ears bleed. Before he could reply, one of the Nazi trucks came by with Hitler's voice blaring from a gramophone record. Dora watched it pass. Sometimes she said, I feel like we're on horseback. She meant he knew that Hitler had a private plane and traveled to 15 well-staged rallies each day. The party had many brave horse cavalry handing out leaflets, but they were charging the machine guns of the 20th century. No, Lusk said, against all the mechanical evidence, the Nazis are the ones in costumes from the past. Only the proletariat can give birth to the future. In my story, in real life too, in history, all three are forced to flee to the Soviet Union, all three being Lusk, their daughter, and Dora. To the Soviet Union, where Stalin, as a reward for their work against fascism, has Lusk arrested. Lusk, however, even during torture in the Lubyanka, which includes not even a sip of water, remains a believer in his angel, Lenin. And here's a part of that interrogation. At his next interrogation, the NKVD officer had been a fat man with manicured fingernails. He'd put a pile of pages on the desk next to a pen and a full glass of water. Lusk, not trying to convince the man he wasn't the spy who should be shot, but only that he should let him have a sip of the water, had said, "Ludwig Vlask's arrest was an exception to the usually accurate determinations of our great party." "No," the man had said, "you're no exception. You're typical petty bourgeois excrement. Look, for example, how attached you are to your name." He paused, picking up the water, and put it down again without drinking, and Lusk's eyes had followed the glass as if he were taking a neurological test. The interrogator had looked at this quivering coward with disgust and said he couldn't possibly have ever been a loyal party member, or he would have recognized that the greatest danger to the party is not that an innocent man might be convicted, but that an exception might prove the party had been wrong even once in its judgment, and so undermine the working class faith in its judgment and in the wisdom of Stalin and Lenin. He gestured for Lusk to approach the desk and read the statement the party had prepared for him, which only asked him to acknowledge that he'd been a deviationist, which would mean not a bullet to the head for him, but 5 years in a labor camp. That would have seemed like paradise to Lusk if the document hadn't also listed everyone who worked at the Marxist-Leninist Institute in Moscow with him as co-conspirators. Alas, a small fold in Lusk's brain had stored a grain of poison, a line from a notebook of Kafka's. "The reservations with which you take evil into yourself are not yours, but those of evil." Which had meant that from a very momentary and completely regrettable sense of shame and a weak but habitual desire to prove himself to Dorr to be as good as a man who supposedly wouldn't lie, though who but he himself had ever tortured that man, Lusk had set the papers back down next to the chipped glass of water. The moment the pages had touched the desk, Lusk had seen that they'd reinstate the charge that he'd been a Gestapo agent, and he'd given an involuntary shriek of regret and despair. The interrogator had looked at him as if he'd shat his britches in front of him. Still, he gave Lusk one last chance to save his wife and daughter. "My daughter?" Lusk had said. "Of course your daughter," the interrogator had said. "Your wife is the spouse of a traitor to the motherland. According to the legal code, she too is an enemy of the people. If you don't sign, I'll have the bitch arrested tonight, and I'll order your daughter taken to an orphanage where the sickly little mongrel will surely die." He'd held out a pen for Lusk, and Lusk had taken the instrument into his hand. Would it be right for him to betray 50 co-workers for a daughter he hardly knew? A girl who was a kind of fetish to him that meant love or the future, when she wasn't any of those things but only a 4-year-old with damaged kidneys who wouldn't survive for very long, no matter what he did. This calculus of years gained per person tortured was the objective materialist view. And in that perspective, which had guided Lusk's whole life, his daughter was, like all individuals, only a piece of dust. Yet all that had mattered to him at that moment was that that speck should spend however much life she might have in the care of her mother, who would make sure she got enough to eat and would tuck her own blue shawl around her at night so his daughter might sleep warmly. In fact, at that moment, there was suddenly no end to the good things he wanted for his daughter. Even that there might be penicillin for her, for this one child, even if it meant all the progress that the socialist state had made towards industrialization would come to ruin. He'd wanted her not to die, though the great mass of humanity might die. And if life was for almost all men an endless crucifixion, he hadn't wanted it to be that for his daughter. Yes, more than anything on earth, He'd wanted his daughter to be an exception. He'd signed the paper. "You can have it now," the interrogator had said, sounding as disgusted with Lusk as before. Lusk had drained the glass, spilling some on his chin and his chest. In the story and in history, Lusk is sent to the Gulag, and Dora is able to flee with the child to England. There, Dora works ceaselessly to preserve Yiddish culture during and after the Holocaust. After Dora's death, Lusk is released from the Gulag. He does eventually reunite with his daughter and feels that Kafka's influence coming to her through her mother is ruining her life. To free her of that, he sends entries from Kafka's diaries that he had supposedly read before the Nazis seized them from Dora's and his apartment. Of course, like me, he's making that up, though in his case, his jealousy makes that imitation one of the hardest things he's done in his life. He feels like, he says, he's being buggered by Kafka. And with what result? You'll have to read the book to find out. The last story in the book is about Milena, who was arrested by the Nazis for her work against them and sent to Ravensbrück, which, terrible though it was for years a concentration camp for political opponents rather than a death camp. There, Milena meets Eva, based on Margaret Buber Neumann, another former German communist who, like Lusk, fled to the Soviet Union, and who, like Lusk, had been sent to the Gulag. When Hitler signed a pact with Stalin, she'd been sent back to Germany. She and Milena fall in love, and Milena passes on some of her inheritance from Kafka. Here's an excerpt from their story as they talk in hiding in a storeroom. Milena liked gypsies well enough, she said, but loathed their music, which had been playing day and night in the bar below her in the villa where she had tried to clean herself of morphine addiction that had begun from a leg injury. She'd drift in and out of consciousness, and each time she used to come back to a world made nauseating by that awful Romany music. "I couldn't have known," Eva said, "not about the music or the ski injury or the morphine or so much else." She felt forlorn. "Oh, God, I'm sorry," Milena said. "I'm not angry at you." She'd gotten a letter from her own daughter that day, and it had been, she said, a perfectly nice letter, a polite letter, but it had nothing in it but news of exams and piano lessons, words written for the censors. When Milena wanted to know, she didn't know what, but something that could bring her daughter closer, let Milena feel her child's need and her confusions. Some details, something about boys, or about if she's gotten her first stockings yet. Milena wept. Eva took her into her arm and stroked her hair, glad that she was allowed to care for her this time, though she also, meanly enough, felt cheated. Milena talked about her father, a doctor, who would raise their daughter, Jenna, after she died. "God save her. That man put me in a mental hospital to break up my relationship with a Jew." "Kafka?" "No, Pollock, my first husband." Eva couldn't help herself. "Why wouldn't he fuck you?" The question made her stop crying, and Eva felt the joy of this accomplishment, felt it more sharply, too, than she had the times she'd helped her own child stop crying. "Pollock? He stopped fucking me from boredom. But really, you mean Kafka." "Everyone," she said, "means Kafka." Oddly, that made her smile. "He feared the flesh," she said, "but not like a neurotic. Or no, perhaps it's the way Franz said. A neurosis also has something true in it that the illness grows around, like a tumor." In this case, that meant that Kafka saw that we're truly animals with teeth. Which was a funny thing to say, because of course many of hers and Eva's were already falling out. "If people are going to fuck," Milena said, "they mustn't see each other's selfishness and violence so clearly. Franz, though, couldn't not see, and he couldn't lie to anyone, not even himself. So he still loved me, but he couldn't fuck me. Do you think I'm very blind, Eva asked, still stroking Milena's hair, which had thinned a little and was streaked with gray. Do you mean, do I think you don't see how vicious I really am? She looked sorrowful. Yes, Eva, you make too much of me, and maybe I of you. For example, I think you're as honest as Franz, even about yourself. But who knows? Maybe I'm wrong about both of you. That made her smile. But I can't really see how I could be wrong. I suppose it's like the eye not being able to see itself. It can, Eva said, in a mirror. Well, that mirror will be the book you'll write for me later. But I know now I won't be there to read it. Neither talking of herself or self-pity were like her, Eva thought. Or perhaps Eva was lost in her illusions and didn't know what was like Milena anymore. The idea of Milena's absence terrified her. The music outside was ending. She hurried to have more of Milena and stroked her back, felt her ribs beneath her sweet, dry skin, and prayed that her touch might give Milena as much comfort as Milena's touch would have given her. Her hands ran over Milena's ass and legs, and she felt the bones in Milena's thighs. That touch made both Milena's body and her own fingers present to her. She looked towards the opaque window pane, and it undulated a little in her eyes like a lake rippled by wind. For a moment, she imagined they were on a boat. They aren't. They're in a concentration camp. Milena dies, and Eva survives Ravensbrück. Or does she? The time in her life that had been made vivid by love had been spent in hell. To remain with Milena, to write about her, is to remain trapped within a trauma. To leave Milena's memory behind would be merely to exist, a life without savor, one she feels not worth living. I thought it was again something like the problem she'd had if she was a character in a story by Franz Kafka. I should warn you, this last story is the happiest one in this book, and then in it, Eva decides on imprisonment in the past. Best for Milena's daughter, for her own, for her former comrades, if Eva never spoke to any of them again. She didn't belong with them or in the land of the living, but only in a place carved inside herself, where even if you were capable of sight, there was nothing but fields of snow that asked nothing from you and offered less in return. Maybe she would settle in that hut and write the book she'd promised Milena, the one about the camps and about Milena. That could be Eva's world within the hut. For God's sakes, no, her therapist said in her imagination, more agitated and concerned than she might have expected. You mustn't lock yourself away with her. No one's worth that sacrifice. Well, at that, Franz Kafka, she imagined, would have responded with a companionable but bitter laugh, like brandy made into sound. He'd tell the doctor that he might know about others and the love they evoked, but he'd never understood their living flame, the reckless, caring, courageous Milena Jasenska. Her death, Kafka would agree, would leave a sane person with only one wish left, and writing her in Milena's book would let Eva satisfy that desire, let her climb into the grave with Milena and all the things she'd given Eva, her long fingers stroking the sides of Eva's breast, the look of the startled crows, the yellow of a child's pajamas, the helpless wounding angels that would provide mute company as she and they were both ushered out of life altogether. Or more likely, writing and revising would make her memories less painful and less vivid, leave the yellow paler, the crows more worn and distant, and Eva would emerge from the hut with a manuscript and years left to live, a woman mild and purposeless, except for the times when the comrades would slander Milena and what was left of Eva Munzenberg would give them a sharp galvanic kick. Eva didn't look forward to either ending. But in any case, to write a book, a person has to eat and keep warm. She got her coat, went down the stairs to a cafe in Heidelberg to provision herself with some overheated coffee and stale pastry before she set to work. I conclude now with a few warning words about angels. Some, as you know, are like Lenin or the German Volk or even free markets, and are, I feel, much in nature like the angel of death. But the valuable ones, I'm sure, are not like that, or like Hitler's, like Rilke's angel, who serenely disdains to destroy us. The ones I'm drawn to are angels because of their precious weakness, their bewilderment, their inability to lie. The modern Kafka-style angel is indeed hardly fit for life, rather than more powerful than life. Those angels sincerely believe we're better than they are, more fit for the world, which makes the condemnation of our dishonesty that their examples provide that much worse. We end up leveling the accusation of deceit or whatever against ourselves. As a character in my stories says about the Yiddish language, these immortals won't die, but only in the sense that they will survive forever if we never for a moment look away from them, fail to keep them in our hearts and speak about them with our lips, as I'm trying to do here. Kafka is perhaps in that way, at this moment, like poor dying literature. And so no wonder, he said prophetically, I am literature. These modernist angels won't accept false comfort, but go on with their maimed art, their endless whining. I can't go on, I'll go on, as another non-inhabitant of the non-heaven of these angels said. That's maybe as close as Kafka, Beckett, or the inhabitants of the heart of darkness that has just passed, if it's passed, might want us to come to hope, which I hope is close enough to sustain us. Thank you.